Peter B. Collins, News and Comment, on Monday, September 24th. News from Guantanamo. Now, there hasn't been a jailbreak, but there's been a break in the jailing.
Tonight there's gonna be a jailbreak somewhere in this town. See, me and the boys, we don't like it, so we're getting up and going down. Hiding low, looking right to left. If you see us coming, I think it's best to move away. Do you hear what I say from under my breath?
Yes, the Cuban gulag, devised by Bush and Cheney because they thought it would be outside the purview of American courts and law. Well, there's been a little break in the action. Now, people haven't actually been released. But in a curious announcement made late Friday, about the same time that Mitt Romney was releasing part of his tax returns and hoping you wouldn't pay close attention, the Obama White House disclosed the identities of 55 prisoners out of the 167 remaining who have been cleared for release. Now, it doesn't say when they'll be going from Guantanamo. And the reason for naming all but a handful of these individuals is not clear. It could be to try to grease the way to send them to friendly third nations. And some have already been resettled in that manner, but always secretly. And if you're a longtime listener, you know that I revealed my contact with a couple of former Guantanamo prisoners who were resettled in that manner. And their attorneys cannot confirm the knowledge that I have of their location in European nations because they've been gagged by our government. So with that background, it is hard to figure why they have announced that these 55 guys are cleared for takeoff, but there is no jet on the runway, and there is no destination so far. And for the best coverage, first of all, I'll tell you that it was the Mooney paper, the Washington Times, that first sent me an alert saying, oh no, Obama's releasing the worst of the worst from Guantanamo. Well, all of these people have been cleared of any even remote connection to terrorism. And some of them have been languishing, awaiting their release for years now. But the LA Times ran a story over the weekend about this based mostly on the White House coverage. Three of those named Friday are Chinese Muslims of the Uyghur minority, but most are from Yemen. And to get the real information, I suggest you go to Andy Worthington's website, andyworthington.co.uk. He's the only journalist I know in the whole world who has devoted so much to detailed coverage of our prison and the people, individuals, who have been held there. He's profiled almost every one of them. And he, too, is puzzled as to why this announcement was made, given the history. And I want to point out that one Yemeni will not be going home at any time, because he died on September 8th. Adnan Farhan Abdul Latif was held there for 10 years without charge, and he was originally cleared for release based on a mistaken identity in 2004. So 8 years after he was told, you can go home someday, he was still trapped at Guantanamo. Now, it's alleged by the government, and they've offered us no proof, that he took his own life. His own lawyer says that's plausible because he had attempted suicide many times before. He was damaged goods when he got to Guantanamo, mentally ill. He had gone to Pakistan and then Afghanistan seeking low-cost medical care and got caught up in our bounty dragnet, and was one of the first people interned at Guantanamo Bay. And one other case that we have noted on this program and talked in some detail about is Omar Khadr, the Canadian picked up as a teenager. His father was in Afghanistan on jihad. And when an American died in the crossfire, this teenager was held responsible. And last week, September 19, marked his 26th birthday. A year ago, he took a plea deal that was supposed to top out his sentence at 8 more years. And it was announced that he was going to be able to serve out the remainder of his term in his native Canada. And as Zandi Worthington points out, for a change, his ongoing detention is not America's fault, but instead the fault of the Canadian government, which is dragging its heels regarding its return, his return. And in a an internment of another type, Dateline Shanghai. Foxconn Technology, the major supplier to some of the world's electronics giants, including the makers of that Apple iPhone 5 that so many people are envious of and some people already have in their hot little hands, said it had closed one of its largest Chinese plants today after police were called in to break up a fight among factory employees. More than 1,000 workers were involved in a disturbance that escalated into a riot on Sunday. Now, I can only speculate that they were working 70-plus hours a week to meet the demand for the new iPhone 5. Unconfirmed pictures and video showed smashed windows, riot police officers, large groups of workers milling around. Chinese state-run media said 5,000 cops were called in to quell the riot. And Foxconn has declined to say whether the plant that was the scene of these acts actually made the iPhone 5. We don't know. But in France, people who work for Apple have announced a day of solidarity with workers in China, September 28th. Now, it's unclear exactly what their protest will be, but they want store staffers to protest in front of the Apple stores where they work. That, of course, could put them at risk of losing their jobs. And this is to show solidarity for employees at China's Foxconn manufacturing plants. Love to see some action like that in the United States. Maybe show up and wave your iPhone around and let people know that while you like the product, you do not approve of the way it's made. Another very interesting story surfaced late on Friday. The State Department has announced that they are removing from the international terrorism list a murky group called the Mujahideen Khalq, the People's Mujahideen, also better known as the MEK. Now, we've talked about the MEK for years on this program, going back to 2007 or so with Larissa Alexandrovna from Raw Story. More recently, in our Boiling Frogs interview series, Sibel Edmonds has referenced the MEK. And this is a terror group. We have used them when it has been convenient for American interests. And the stories going back to 07 related to the Bush administration's payments to the MEK, providing them with undercover tools, and moving them from part of Iraq into Iran. And what is interesting is the New York Times, in a front page story on Saturday, revealed that this terrorist group, which has just been sanitized, it's been scrubbed off the list, has a lot of high-powered, influential, paid lobbyists with connections to our government, like two former CIA directors, James Woolsey and Porter Goss, former FBI director Louis Freeh, Bush's Homeland Security Secretary Tom Ridge, and former Attorney General Mukasey, Obama's first National Security Advisor James Jones, journalists like Carl Bernstein, Clarence Page, the columnist for the Chicago Tribune, and even a guy who I'm really sorry to see on this list, P.J. Crowley. He resigned as an assistant secretary of state. after acknowledging some of the craziness of Obama foreign policy positions. And Ed Rendell, former Democratic governor of Pennsylvania, got paid $150,000 to go to Paris and speak to a group aligned with the MEK. Now, what's fascinating to me about this, and you know I'm obsessed with the National Defense Authorization Act and the ability to detain Americans for the flimsiest connection to terrorists, as I read the Section 1021 of the NDAA, every one of these people is subject to arrest, to detention without limit, to be held at a military base without charge or trial. But because they're well-connected, because they've been paid to flack for MEK, they got them off the terrorism list. You and I, or Chris Hedges, the journalist who was the lead plaintiff in the case challenging the NDAA, would not have that confidence, would we? Very interesting. Now, meanwhile, over at NBC News, there's a report that aired in the Rock Center show, anchored by Brian Williams last week, that says the MEK is responsible for the deadly attacks on Iranian nuclear scientists in Iran. That's right. Here's how it reads. Quote, this is under the byline of Richard Engel, their foreign correspondent. Deadly attacks on Iranian nuclear scientists are being carried out by an Iranian dissident group that is financed, trained, and armed by Israel's Secret Service. Who are we talking about? The MEK, the People's Mujahideen of Iran. And so, this is a clear admission that the MEK's terrorism is not a thing of the past. It's not historical. It's not like they've changed their stripes. They're our terrorists. They're doing our dirty work for the United States and Israel. And the corporate media that reports this doesn't consider the draconian elements of the NDAA and how it should be applied to the Americans who have sympathized with this group. Ah, but they're terrorists who are working for us. So that's okay. But if Chris Hedges wanted to interview them before they had been scrubbed from this list, who knows what the government would have done, because in the court proceedings, the government attorneys would never specify what might get Chris Hedges into trouble and what was permissible in their eyes. Now, the United Nations is having its General Assembly this week, and there'll be a lot of coverage, not of the in-depth issues, but just of the personalities and some of the rhetoric that will fly from the podium in New York. And, of course, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, the president of Iran, will be offering more inflammatory statements that will be picked up and used to distract us from what's really going on. And likewise, Bibi Netanyahu, the prime minister of Israel, who's still miffed that Obama would rather be taping The View than meeting with him, he'll be campaigning for Mitt Romney. I mean, that's what he's been doing. Even the Israelis know it and are uncomfortable with it, according to a story in the New York Times over this past weekend. One more item on Iran. Gareth Porter, a frequent contributor to this program and one of the most effective journalists studying international issues these days, has a new story out reporting that Iran has made an offer to halt its enrichment of uranium at the level of 20% enrichment. And in terms that you and I can understand, that means you could use it to run a nuclear power plant, but it's not powerful enough to create a bomb. Their lead negotiator, Ali Asghar Soltaniyeh, hope I got his name right, quote, we are prepared to suspend enrichment to 20% provided we find a reciprocal step compatible with it. We said this in Istanbul. That's weeks ago. And what's the quid pro quo? They want an end to the sanctions. So here's a deal that we're just learning about that was made in the presence of the U.S. and others arrayed against Iran at this meeting in Istanbul. That was on, I don't have the date in front of me, but it was a few weeks back. And in the interim, Netanyahu has ignored all that, called for the U.S. to draw a bright line, a red line, some sort of line, and join him in a mad quest to start a war with Iran. On 60 Minutes last night, they presented interviews with the two corporate candidates for president, Barack Obama and Mitt Romney. And not a whole lot of new ground was covered. There was one zinger from Obama at Romney, where he basically said when Romney goads him on being more aggressive against Iran and towing the foreign policy line of Israel, he said, well, you know, if Mr. Romney wants to start another war, he ought to just say so. And one quote from the president that rankles American Zionists is he referred to Israel as one of our best allies in the Middle East. And that's not good enough. I heard one commentator on local radio here, an extreme Zionist, say that this is insulting. That for the president not to say that Israel is our only and number one ally in the region is a mistake and an insult. Well, I think he's treading a very fine line, trying not to further radicalize Muslims around the world by standing too close to Israel. I think it was a kind of constructive ambiguity. And I think that Mitt Romney is reckless. He speaks with no ambiguity, with no constructive contributions, in my view. And when I size them up, you know my criticisms of President Obama and why I have decided that because I live in California, I can afford to cast a protest vote this year. I won't be voting for him. But Romney just displayed time and again that he doesn't know what he's talking about. He talks in circles, doesn't answer the question, and acts like everything is just so clear about what his policies are and how his economic program would work. It doesn't add up. It doesn't pencil out. And when pressed, he just says, well, I'll work it out with the Congress. And Mitt is hoping that religious forces will come to his rescue. And Ralph Reed is one of the political evangelicals who has lined up with Mitt Romney. Even though Romney's not an evangelical, he's not even a Protestant. But, of course, we have this dangerous African-American pro-abortion baby killer president, and there are a lot of emotional arguments that can be laid on evangelicals to scare them into voting for Romney. And Ralph Reed, who was tied up in the Abramoff scandal and has apparently been able to scrub his record to the extent that he could raise about $12 million from religious contributors across the country. So he may well be a factor in the outcome of this year's election. I think that it's going to be a matter of whether the voter suppression tactics and other methods used by the Republicans to suppress, manipulate, and distort the vote will be successful, particularly in battleground states. I commend the New York Times for an enterprise story in Sunday's edition, which recaps the final year of the American occupation of Iraq. And we knew about the efforts by Obama, Leon Panetta, and others to plead with the government in Baghdad to let us keep more troops there for the foreseeable future. And the Iraqis said no, which enabled President Obama to claim during this fall's campaign that he ended the war in Iraq and that he kept his promise. But he tried real hard not to keep that promise. And what is most amazing about this New York Times story is that there was an effort in the summer of 2011 to get Maliki, the Shiite puppet, to share power with Ayad Alawi. Alawi, of course, was the choice of the Bush administration to rule Iraq, but they couldn't manipulate the politics on the ground to support it. And why Obama's people would trot this discredited man out again and try to insert him into the power structure in Iraq as we were preparing to leave the country is beyond me. Now, he does have broader support among Sunnis and the former supporters of the Saddam regime government. The Saddam Hussein government, and I almost said the word regime there. And so, you know, it recaps how there were talks in the inner circles of the Obama administration, first about keeping 25,000 troops, and then 16,000, and then 10,000, and finally, it was the Iraqis who said, "Hey guys, how about zero? How about zero?" Juan Cole is a professor at the University of Michigan, an expert on foreign policy, and he wrote a post over the weekend that opened my eyes a little bit. I watch Bill Maher's show, Real Time, on HBO whenever it's on, and sometimes I really like it, and other times it's kind of a pain when he has too many conservatives on, or when he fails to respond to the ravings of conservatives. Last week's show was pretty good, but as Professor Cole points out, Bill Maher, when he was commiserating with Salman Rushdie, made a statement, quote, "At least half of all Muslims believe it's all right to kill someone who insults the Prophet." And this is a little strong, but Professor Cole calls it blood libel and bigotry. And he goes on to say that while Maher is an outspoken atheist, that he is a strong supporter of Israel and displays a lot of Islamophobic tendencies. Read his piece at juancole.com and see what you think. I wanted to point out as well that the New York Times repeatedly refers to the new president of Egypt as Islamic or an Islamist. Over the weekend, Mohamed Morsi gave an interview, which I found very interesting, and you may have read all or part of it yourself. But he talks about trying to dial back U.S. support for Israel, trying to balance it with support for the Palestinians, and that is at the root of so many of the conflicts in the Middle East. I think it's a wise bit of advice from a man on the scene. But he is always tagged as Islamic. So in the page one story that jumps to the inside of the New York Times, the second headline reads, "Egypt's Islamist leader spells out terms for ties between U.S. and Arab world." Now, when are they going to stop this? Yes, he came out of the Muslim Brotherhood. Yes, he is Islamic. But we don't hear or see a headline that reads, "Christian President Obama says such and such." We don't do that. I imagine at World Nut Daily it says, you know, "Islamic President Obama says such and such." But that's hardly a credible outlet. So I just want you to be aware of this. Whenever you see a report on Mohamed Morsi, look for the Islamic label. If it's in the corporate media, it will be there. And finally, today's mail brought a note from Don Siegelman, incarcerated in a federal prison in the South. "Thanks so much for thinking of me, and thanks for believing in me," he says. And he invites me to be in touch with his daughter, Dana, and I will. I'll have her on the show in the next few weeks. And he closes saying, "All my best to you, my friend. We the people will win justice for all in the end." Well, Governor, I hope your optimism is rewarded. and sooner than later. Thanks for joining me for news and comment. Share this podcast with your friends. It's free.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling until